Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotin in Washington, D.C.
The Ghanaian people, the women groups, the Association of Disabled People, a variety of NGOs, the religious groups, the chiefs, were committed to peace.
Former Botswana president commends the people of Ghana for the conduct of the general election.
It is very important to ensure that communication and rhetorics are responsible and that they duly take into consideration the gravity of the situation. And this is a position that is upheld within the Congolese government. We hope it is the same case on the other side. I think what is also a crucial aspect that we should not lose from perspective is that amidst rhetoric, we also have facts and we also have actions.
Angolan President João Lourenço plans to meet leaders from DRC and Rwanda on Sunday.
Well, the whole intention of starting this civic formation is to awaken the opportunities available for the opposition in working together. Because over the last 3 years, the opposition has had the misfortune of working in a fractured manner.
And the former leader of the Ugandan opposition in parliament launches a new political group. We'll have details. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Ghana, the head of the Commonwealth Poll Observer Mission has expressed satisfaction with the conduct of last week's general election. Mokgweetsi Masisi, the former president of Botswana, commended the government, civil society, stakeholders, and people of Ghana for the orderly conduct of the just-concluded presidential and legislative elections. His remarks come after the Electoral Commission declared former President John Dramani Mahama as winner of the presidential contest. Incumbent Vice President Mahamudu Bawumia had earlier called to concede before publicly congratulating the former president for his victory. For more on the assessment of the conduct of the December 7 general election, I reached former President Mokgweetsi Masisi via video link.
We established that the institutions were ready, were willing, and the parties were ready, were willing. And as you'd expect in any democratic contest, there was a lot of, anxiety and contestation, which is healthy. And the poll was conducted. It was successfully conducted. And I say successfully because, on the main, they were free, fair, credible, and acceptable. Acceptable because quite early on the 8th, the day following the elections, the vice president, who was a presidential candidate for the ruling party, NPP, conceded magnanimously. And he demonstrated immense statesmanship. And that was very useful as it contributed to the calming of the tensions. As you know, there were some reported unfortunate incidents, one of which resulted in the demise of a citizen. But on the main, the Ghanaian people, the women groups, the Association of Disabled People, a variety of NGOs, the religious groups, the chiefs, were committed to peace.
Mr. President, how did the parties and the voters behave during the polling, including the other stakeholders, per your observation?
On an assessment of everything put together, they behaved very well. They committed to the election process. They were ready. They were charged up, wanting to win. So they were eager to make sure that they got their voters to vote. They looked after the process. They supervised it, so to speak. The party agents were there. The police, who were the chief law enforcers, were agile and ready. And I must commend the Ghanaian police because they really stood out as beacons of peace through law enforcement. Never did they have to lift a baton, a firearm, whether rubber bullets or live bullets. And according to their own words, didn't even need to lift a finger. And this is despite the fact that tensions were high. And they adopted a strategy of de-escalation, And there was continuous engagement of the parties and continuous pleading of the parties to have the leaders prevail on their supporters to calm down.
In your observation, how was the performance of the Electoral Commission like?
I think the Electoral Commission executed itself, you know, admirably under the circumstances. Clearly going to the election, there was a lot of assault of their integrity, assault of their legitimacy, and assault of trust that was directed towards them. And they parried that by constantly engaging and being more transparent, inviting the media and the public into their processes and announcing. And, you know, it's not an easy task when you have competing interests suggesting that you're, you know, supporting one or the other or not being as fair as you ought to be. But they, you know, executed their mandate as per the dictates of the law.
So, Mr. President, before you go, I know your time is short, but before you go, what are the major takeaways for you and for your observer, the Commonwealth Observer team, after monitoring or observing Ghana's elections?
Well, one, we've been impressed by the institutions. There's a deep, deep institutional willingness, want, embracement of values of peace. That can be said for the Ghanaian public. Ghanaians are a very peaceful, honorable, self-respecting people. And so this, you know, black star shines bright over here as you come, very proud of the institutions, very proud of their democracy, very proud of making a choice, very proud to compete. And so the liveliness of contest is very healthy for a democracy. And so the embracement of this democracy is really, really admirable. There are clear takeaways with respect to issues that we are all faced with in many developing countries, that is of the demographic dividend vis-a-vis economy and ability to generate, to develop the jobs necessary. But, you know, we were constantly playing back to the institutions, to the participants, to the players, that the Commonwealth is made up of nation states who commit to a certain compact of values. And this, the Ghanaian public embraced, which is admirable. And in those values are the criterial elements of democratic dispensation. That is laudable, particularly in a neighborhood in which there's been a backslide in democratic behavior and conduct. And so there's a lot of hope. So I go away refreshed in my conviction of the validity of democracy, in the validity of Ghana as a state and a people. And when I visit other places, I can very proudly point out to Ghana for being an example that should be followed, including the world. There are many developed countries that also borrow a lot from Ghana, including where you are.
Former Botswana President Mokgweetsi Masisi is the head of the Commonwealth Poll Observer Mission. He spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Still in Ghana, the chairperson of African Women Leaders Network says the election of Jane Nana Opokuagyeman as the first female vice president is a game changer. Charity Binka also says she expects the incoming administration to include more women in decision-making areas within the government. Her remarks come after the Electoral Commission officially declared former President John Dramani Mahama as the winner of last Saturday's presidential contest. His running mate, Jane Nana Opokuagyeman, is Professor of Literature and former Education Minister. Charity Binka tells me that the Vice President-elect serves as a significant boost to efforts to get more women in politics and leadership positions, both in government and in private institutions.
We were all very excited. In fact, many congratulating messages started flying here and there. Some of us had even prepared our flyers to congratulate her even before the official declaration was made, because we've been waiting for so long. And for me, we keep on talking about the glass ceiling. I think that there are, for me, it's like we have two layers of this glass ceiling. The first one has been shattered, and I think we need to get to the next one. That is the ultimate, getting to become the president.
Looking at the choice and the victory that came subsequently, what does this mean to women groups and for young girls in Ghana?
In fact, for us, it was a monumental milestone, not just for women in Ghana or girls, but for the entire nation. We expect that it should be an inspiration to women and girls who think that we can never get anywhere near presidency to know that it is possible if we persevere. And I watched her throughout the campaign, and I was amazed at the energy that she brought into the whole campaign. I watched her and I was really shocked. She has so much energy. Not only does she have energy, she has substance. The message that she was giving, the message could clearly resonate with many Ghanaians. So she made us proud.
Some, I understand, discourage their female children from going into politics because of sometimes abuse they get. Although there have been some who have been into parliament and all that. What does this mean for women or girls deciding to go into politics?
Certainly. I think it will encourage many parents, not only parents, to allow their daughters to get into politics, but women themselves, people who are adults, who can make decisions on their own without parental guidance, that it is possible, that they can do it with persistence, with perseverance, with determination. This woman, she put in her all. She was everywhere. She met all the people who matter. She met journalists, female journalists. She had time for everybody. She brought in all her skills. And that one thing that she has proved why is that when you are focused, there's nothing you can do. It doesn't matter whether you are a man or a woman. This victory and this nomination that has become a reality, that we are going to have the very first female vice president in this country, is truly a game changer for many people who are still in doubt that women cannot do it. Parents who are thinking that their daughters are only good for marriage and all that, and for maybe to go into certain types of vocation and not even try to get into politics, definitely is going to make a difference. And for us, some of us in the gender space, we want to re-look at our strategies. We want to re-strategize. We have already started discussions even before the victory, even before the elections, to see how we can start conversations around women involvement in politics ahead of 2028 elections.
Charity Binka is the chairperson of African Women Leaders Network in Ghana. She spoke with me from the capital, Accra. The DRC's Minister of Foreign Affairs, International Cooperation and Francophone says Angolan President João Lourenço plans to host DRC President Félix Tshisekedi and Rwandan President Paul Kagame on December 15 in Luanda. Therese Kayikwamba Wagner says the meetings form part of Angola's effort to ease political tensions between the governments in Kinshasa and Kigali. DRC has often accused Rwanda of backing the M23 rebels who are in the eastern part of the country. Rwanda denies the accusation. Human rights groups accuse the rebels of committing war crimes and crimes against humanity. In a wide-ranging interview, including Angola's efforts to resolve diplomatic tensions between the DRC and Rwanda, I had a sit-down interview with Wagner. Here is the conclusion of the conversation.
Talking about accountability, critics of both countries say that although there appear to be a political will to ease the political tension with peace talks organized by Angola, rhetoric from both sides have not been too good for the process. How committed is your administration to ensure that the political rhetoric is toned down to help with Angola's efforts and regional efforts, continental efforts, to resolve these issues that you have?
It is very important to ensure that communication and rhetorics are responsible and that they duly take into consideration the gravity of the situation. And this is a position that is upheld within the Congolese government. We hope it is the same case on the other side. I think what is also a crucial aspect that we should not lose from perspective is that amidst rhetoric, we also have facts and we also have actions. And I know that rhetoric and that political speech can exacerbate situations and tensions, but I am more concerned, in all transparency, about the realities on the ground. When I speak about violations of human rights, when I speak of violations of the ceasefire, on Monday I was at the Security Council. There was a dedicated session on the situation in the Eastern DRC. We had permanent members and non-permanent members of the Security Council speaking out against specific issues that have been observed. The case of the United States of America that condemned the use of GPS jamming and spoofing, a technology that prevents aircrafts from navigating safely, that has been exposing millions of Congolese civilians who live in densely populated area to the risks of air traffic accidents. So there are very tangible situations and violations that show that acts are even more eloquent than words. Of course, we want to diffuse tensions. We want to hold all parties to a more responsible standard of communication. But at the same time, it should not distract us from what is happening on the ground. And those are violations of territorial integrity of the DRC by the Rwandan Defense Forces, the use of GPS jamming technology, as well as violations of the ceasefire and Rwanda's unavailability or unwillingness to participate in a constructive manner to the ad hoc verification mechanism. These are, for me, even greater concerns than political speech. But we do hold also high value to the fact that political communication has to be responsible.
Madam Foreign Minister, before we go, in January, we'll have a new administration in Washington. What are your expectations? How do you want to engage the incoming administration? And what should be the expectations of the people of DRC and the challenges you face and how you want America as a partner to help in that effort to resolve some of the issues you face?
I think we are in a privileged position in the DRC to be able to look back at decades of partnership with the USA that have been very fruitful and that have been very constructive. So I do not think I'm overly optimistic when I say that my expectation is continuity. Continuity in these excellent relationships. We had very good ties and made a lot of progress with the Biden administration. But before that, there was a first Trump administration with which we had excellent relationships also. So I have the expectation that we will continue on issues of shared interest. One pivotal issue was the Lobito Corridor Summit, which was held last week in Angola and brought together leaders from the DRC, Angola, the USA, of course, Zambia, and the vice president of Tanzania, if I'm not mistaken. And so this was such a crucial moment because it showed us to what extent investments in something as critical as the Lobito Corridor, which is not just an infrastructure project, has the potential to outlive us all as political leaders and, you know, create opportunities and wealth for generations to come. And I think these are interests that prevail and interests that continue and remain valid even when you have a change of administration. Just as I think that values, principles also remain constant. We know that President Trump has expressed the wish to respond to some very dramatic conflicts that we're seeing across the world. He has spoken up about the situation in or the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, the situation in the Middle East. Our hope, our expectation is that he also is attentive to the very dramatic situation in the Great Lakes region and that we can hope to have a continuity in terms of the diplomatic and political efforts and commitment of the USA to find a durable solution to this conflict. And I think, again, I am not being overly optimistic. I think these are values that have always characterized the U.S., and I think we can rely on that.
Madam Foreign Minister, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Therese Kayikwamba Wagner is DRC's Minister of Foreign Affairs, International Cooperation and Francophonie. She spoke with me from here in Washington. In Uganda, a former leader of the opposition in parliament has launched the Democratic Alliance, or DA, a new political and civic group. Mathias Mpuuga, who is also a member of parliament, says his group aims to unite all of the opposition to defeat President Yoweri Museveni and his governing National Resistance Army, or NRM, in the next general election. But critics say divisions among opposition groups makes it easy for President Museveni and his NRM party to continue to win. For more about the newly launched Democratic Alliance, I reach Mathias Mpuuga.
Well, the whole intention of starting this civic formation is to awaken the opportunities available for the opposition in working together. Because over the last 3 years, the opposition has had the misfortune of working in a fractured manner and therefore unable to mount a joint effort, unable to marshal, unable to summon any kind of effort that is joint, that would energize the nation 12 months the next election, and they see there's no activity in sight that shows that the opposition is prepared to stop General Museveni in his tracks, or at least to mount the kind of pressure that we needed to mount, to make sure that we rally the masses, we rally the population, we rally civil society and all other non-political actors to join the quest for a new Uganda in which we're demanding for a free and fair electoral process. Now, initially, that's the objective.
Are you sure that the Democratic Alliance, as you have this civic formation, can pull together all the opposition parties in order to form a united front to challenge the dominance of the NRM and to challenge President Museveni in the presidential contest?
We are talking about politics, where you need to try your luck. You need to try everything possible and feasible for you to have a chance. In the face of no opportunity, in the face of no action, we are trying this, a formidable platform, and we're going to use it to speak to all that we can speak to all platforms, all political parties, that we are able to speak with one voice. And see, probably along the way, we'll be even able to choose joint candidates in different positions to have a chance at challenging the state party in the NRM in Kampala.
You were suspended by the NUP. With this formation, does that mean you have officially ended your association with the NUP, or you still remain a member?
First of all, being a member of an organization is a choice. It's not an eternal situation. So my choice now is to work with the other political groups. And the NUP does not own me. I'm not their property. I'm a citizen with civic duties and responsibilities, which I must discharge regardless. The NUP cannot try to discredit me, then own me, and then disown me at the same time. Because as an organization, it lacks the best minimum internal processes to deal with political disagreements. Therefore, as a citizen, not oblivious of my duties and aware of what I owe my people, my community, my voters, my supporters, I have vowed to do something regardless of what the NUP does at the moment, because I'm not their property.
Some people are suggesting that a plethora of organizations such as yours paves way for the dominance of the NRM to continue and for President Museveni to win elections in Uganda, because they think that the opposition front is divided because of groups such as yours, paving the way for the NRM to continue winning elections in Uganda.
I agree with that assertion, but the question is which organization, which people, which activities? We have so many registered political parties inactive and useless without a defined membership. That's not the DEA. My first public outing had hundreds of people attending it. That should be a sign that mine is not like any other. I can tell you, even without registering it as a political organization, it has a huge following, and therefore you cannot regard it as one of those small outfits out there for grandstanding. We're out there for very serious business, and you're going to see it.
Parliamentarian Mathias Mpuuga is leader of the Democratic Alliance, or DA, a new political and civic group. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. In Malawi, a leading academic says a new survey that shows a majority of citizens think that the country is heading in the wrong direction is a true reflection of the situation on the ground. Boniface Dulani is an associate professor of political science in the Department of Politics and Government at the University of Malawi. He says citizens are displeased that the government has not been able to resolve the economic challenges they face despite repeated promises to do so. This after a new Afrobarometer survey shows that 76% of the respondents say the country is heading in the wrong direction. They also say the government has not done enough to resolve the economic challenges and to fight corruption. For more reaction to the research findings, I reach Boniface Dulani.
For those Malawians on the ground, I think this is not surprising. The country has been going through very difficult economic times. There have been frequent shortages of petrol, especially with long queues at fuel stations in the country. I think food shortages, and the country has also been experiencing food shortages, and I think, you know, this has been worsened, of course, by climatic factors, including the recent cyclone Freddy that hit the country earlier in the year, as well as an extended drought that reduced food shortages. So it's not surprising that many Malawians really are of the opinion that the country is headed in the wrong direction. Of course, maybe there's some glimmer of hope for the government, considering that this time around only 76% of Malawians say the country is headed in the wrong direction. In the last Afrobarometer survey in 2022, 89% of Malawians actually had said that the country was headed in the wrong direction. So at least now, there's a 13 percentage point reduction in the proportion of Malawians that are of the view that the country is headed in the wrong direction.
Talking about a glimmer of hope, a slight majority of Malawians say the government has done a good job in provision of water, reliable electricity, and educational needs, but not necessarily satisfied with the handling of economy, keeping prices stable and narrow. But let's focus on the positives. A slight majority think that the government has done a good job of water, reliable electricity, and educational needs. What do you make of that?
It's fair to say that the provision of electricity, water, education is not just a short-term thing. So it's fair to say that the current government has basically been building on foundations that might have been laid by previous governments and previous administrations, and they just find themselves, I think, in a position where they are reaping the benefits and getting all the credit. Although I think in the area of electricity, when the current government came in, I think the country had been experiencing very frequent and extended power shortages, and I think the previous government had even attempted to bring in a stopgap solution by installing some diesel generators that just proved also to be quite costly and expensive and tainted with also corruption allegations. I think since this government came in, there has indeed been an improvement in availability of electricity, in large part because they were able, I think, to finalize the maintenance of one of the major power stations in the southern part of the country that had been affected by Cyclone Freddy.
One of his, they also talked about the government's ineffectiveness in handling the economy, addressing the economic challenges that many Malawians face, keeping prices stable and narrowing income gaps. And they also faulted the government for not doing enough to fight corruption. Your take?
I think this again resonates very well with what's been going on the ground, because of the economic challenges that the country has been facing. Government has been forced, I think, to devalue the kwacha in, you know, late last year. The Malawi currency was devalued by 44%, and since then, I think the value has even further eroded, in large part because the country really has just not been productive. And this has contributed to shortages of foreign exchange, the consequences of which we are seeing in the challenges in the country's ability to import, including especially critical things like petrol and other fuels.
Boniface Dulani is an associate professor of political science in the Department of Politics and Government at the University of Malawi. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. Malawi is on high alert for the impact of tropical cyclone Chido, which is expected to make landfall in Mozambique Sunday evening. Meteorological experts in Malawi say the cyclone will bring heavy rains and flooding to the south of the country. For VOA, Lamek Masina reports from the Malawian commercial capital, Blantyre.
A weather update from the Malawi's Department of Climate Change and Meteorological Services, released Friday afternoon, says the cyclone, now northeast of Madagascar in the Indian Ocean, has maintained its strength with maximum winds of 250 kilometers per hour. It said the cyclone is expected to sustain that intensity through Saturday afternoon as it slowly moves westward at a speed of 22 kilometers per hour with significant potential for heavy rainfall. According to the update, Cyclone Chido will likely pass through 11 districts in southern Malawi: Manguchi, Machinga, Palombe, Balaka, Mulanje, Blantyre, Tyolo, Chiladzulu, Zomba, Mwanza, and Neno. It's expected to make a landfall Sunday near Nacala in Mozambique, causing heavy rains and flooding in some areas until Tuesday. Chipiriro Kamula is a spokesperson for the Department of Disaster Management Affairs in Malawi. He told VOA that the department has advised people in flood-prone areas to immediately move to higher ground and follow evacuation orders when issued.
We have alerted councils and activated all clusters for swift preparatory and anticipatory actions. We have also made standby arrangements for the deployment of a search and rescue team comprising the Malawi Defense Force, the Malawi Police Service, the Marine Department, and the Malawi Red Cross Society.
Tropical Cyclone Chido comes a year after Cyclone Freddy, which also hit Madagascar, Mozambique, and Zimbabwe, killed over 1,000 people in southern Malawi and washed away large numbers of crops and livestock. This year, even before the coming of cyclone, Malawi has had to cope with the impact of El Nino weather conditions, which caused drought and food shortages for more than a quarter of the country's population of 20 million. Paul Turnbull is the country director for World Food Program in Malawi, which has provided assistance to millions of people affected by the drought. He told VOA via a messaging app on Friday that the WFP has available food stocks in its warehouses to complement the government's food stocks.
These stocks were mainly intended to be food assistance for people affected by El Nino. As the requirements for El Nino persist, if food is needed to respond to Cyclone Chido, WFP would be seeking support to cover these costs so that we would not compromise the support for the ongoing El Nino response.
Turnbull also said the WFP has boats to assist the Malawi government fleet if boats are needed to deliver food and rescue victims of any post-cyclone flooding. Lamek Masina, VOA News, Blantyre.
Namibian political parties scored a legal victory Friday when three judges on the country's electoral court ruled they can examine electoral commission materials from last month's presidential and legislative elections. The parties have rejected election results, which show the long-ruling SWAPO party retaining control of parliament, although with a reduced majority.
For VOA, Vitalio Angula has this report from the Namibian capital, Windhoek.
The two parties, the Independent Patriots for Change, or IPC, and the Landless People's Movement, or LPM, appear to be looking for evidence of irregularities in the elections that returned the Swapo Party to power. Opposition parties say voter turnout was suppressed in some areas due to a lack of ballot papers. But critics argue that even though there were widespread irregularities, they were of a logistical nature and cannot be seen as having affected the final election results. John Nakuta is a human rights lawyer and lecturer at Namibia's National University. Speaking to VOA at the courthouse Friday, Nakuta outlined what he believed the IPC and LPM are trying to accomplish.
So it is as if they want to inspect whether or not there indeed was irregularities, as they seem to be unofficially saying. They want to investigate so as to establish evidence whether there was irregularities, and thereafter they would, I suppose, come back to the court to ask the court to nullify based on the evidence.
A spokesperson for the IPC, Imps Nashinge, says Friday's ruling is just a first step in a legal challenge that the party intends to bring to court in about a week.
We made it clear that we are not accepting anything from this sham of an election from day one. And our colleagues, other political parties such as PDM, UDF and others are in support with us. That's why you have seen, for example, on the day of the announcement, we have not attended none, even if we made it clear before even the results were announced that even if it come out in our favor, we are not going to accept anything because this violates the principles and values of our democracy.
At the courthouse, Elections Commissioner Pius Ikwambi said the commission had already reached an agreement with the aggrieved parties where they offered them the opportunity to inspect election materials, and this court process was just an affirmation of what they had already decided. Electoral Commission spokesperson David Siluka told VOA the political parties that object to the outcome of the elections are themselves to blame for failing to send representatives to the various polling stations to inspect the election process as it was being carried out.
Even allocated them tables, chairs and computers where they could verify, as we verify also, say, okay, this is what we have received from Collation Center. These are the documents that we have received from the polling stations themselves. And here is how we are, because here we only verify to see what we received from, what they received from the Collation Center and what they received at the polling station. Is it adding up? Then we proceed.
22 parties contested the just-ended presidential and national assembly elections in Namibia. Of those, 13 managed to obtain seats in the 104-member National Assembly, where SWAPO holds a majority of 51 seats. The ruling Friday by the Electoral Court says the opposition parties can inspect the forms showing results from various polling stations. Critics say it is unclear what, if anything, the parties will be able to prove once they have done inspecting the documents. Vitalio Angula, VOA News, Windhoek, Namibia.
Right groups are urging Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa to sign into law a bill that will abolish the death penalty following the bill's landmark passage Thursday by the country's Senate after earlier passage by the lower house of parliament. For VOA, Colombo's Mavunga reports from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
In an interview with VOA, Zimbabwe's Justice Minister Ziyambe Ziyambe said passage of the death penalty bill is welcomed by President Emmerson Mnangagwa, who since coming to power in 2017 has refused to sign death warrants for those facing capital punishment.
So he's a man who has not been an advocate of the death penalty. So the passage of the bill by the Senate towards Christmas is an early Christmas present to him, as he has been an advocate to say we can't do this, and that's the reason why I said he is a man who is going to appreciate the work that has been done by both houses.
Human rights groups are now calling for Mnangagwa to sign the bill, among them Lucia Masuka, the head of Amnesty International in Zimbabwe.
Amnesty International commends the progressive legislative efforts made so far to make the abolition of the death penalty from the country's statutes a reality. We urge the president to take heed of this historic landmark decision by signing this bill without delay and commuting all death sentences to prison terms. The death penalty is the ultimate cruel, inhuman, and degrading punishment and has no place in our world.
In the past, Mnangagwa has refused to sign some bills after Parliament had passed them. But Ziyambe says that will not happen this time.
Oh, they say it's an early Christmas present if he does not want to sign it. He's lived the pain and trauma of being on death row and he was saved by a technicality. He's ready to sign like yesterday.
But not everyone is happy with this latest development. One of them is Zakaria Choga, an attorney in Harare.
I still believe adequate research was not properly done in this regard. If you look at the increase in crime in Zimbabwe at the moment, especially violent crimes, robberies, armed robberies to be specific, housebreaking, it's only going to escalate further with the death penalty off the table, because it appeared with the death penalty on the table, it could have been the only deterrent that we had at this particular point. But now with the death penalty gone, we're going to see a rise in violent crimes of that nature.
According to Amnesty International, 24 countries across sub-Saharan Africa have abolished the death penalty for all crimes, while two additional countries have abolished it for ordinary crimes only. Zimbabwe's last known execution was in 2005, though courts continue to impose death sentences for cases of murder committed under aggravating circumstances. In April, all those condemned to death had their sentences commuted to life in prison by President Mnangagwa. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
It's the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from African Collection. But first, now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. There is an interesting development which will be of interest to many Africans. There is now clear evidence that in the northern states, many of them, after elections, are moving more to the right, and some will say authoritarian. In Africa, however, the picture is quite different. After many years of accusing Africa from slipping from democracy, recently Africans are showing resurgence for robust democracy. For example, we have seen that in many countries recently, there was a real commitment to democracy. And many, even when they're losing, they don't wait for the end and they concede. Secondly, African states are emphasizing the importance of peaceful transfer of power. If you take what has happened say, in Senegal, you look at Botswana, and you also have just recently now in Ghana, you see that there is no attempt to be controversial. Although in certain cases in the South, where you have just completed an election in the state where SWAPO was supposed to be losing ground, and there was a speculation in many Western media that SWAPO would have the same problems as the ANC, that the party would lose ground. But the results show quite differently. An election was made of the first woman. Also, the interesting that where in some parts of the global north, electing women candidates are becoming very difficult. The winning candidate got over 50%. Yes, you do have somewhat challenging, but it's very clear that the result will stand. We say this because Africa is always looked as a lost case, but that's not the case now. Secondly, African states are trying not only to have a resurgence in democracy, they are trying to say this democracy is different. They want change, and not change in normal sense. They are saying that all those who win elections, if you notice, are those who want to strengthen the sovereignty in Senegal. They made it clear that the reason why they want Francis Never things to be removed is for them to be able to exercise sovereignty. So let no one tell you Africa is backsliding on democracy. That is not true. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Sabashe, anate musinga, maso. samba clotide motema ya bozo abele na porto la belle fée
comme ta soya mambuya na koka kate joni ela ta baba oho na fila kumbundu
flo ya mioko no rana lela oho
comme ta soya mambuya na koka kate joni ela ta baba oho na fila kumbundu
alo alo misa besange mauku kisindera bosale calling I ai natika limo zemba papa e
simone mama ngana lela o o
manda soya mokuya
mama reto mama
lela za papa o o na fila kumbundu e
na kapenga yoga joni na kapelela yoga joni mutombo yola kia nilima sengoko mama
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English to Africa service of the Voice of America in Washington.
Tumiga ashaka kada, torashada ashaka kada.